This podcast was produced by ORFM Dunedin with support from New Zealand On the Air.
Are you there, Sam?
Yep, hang on, I'm just turning that on.
Is our guest ready?
Yep, I've got the music ready.
Can you hear me okay?
Yep, sounds great.
Cool. Otago Access Radio, in partnership with Otago Polytechnic, brings you Blowing Bubbles.
Blowing Bubbles brings you positive conversations with people in their bubbles around the world.
We're curious about how people are finding new ways of life, being and problem solving. Every Wednesday, the Sustainable Lens team of Samuel Mann and Mawira Karatai reach out from our bubbles to chat with interesting and positive people around the world.
Broadcast on Otago Access Radio, 105.4 FM in Dunedin, and streamed and podcast on oar.org.nz.
Bringing joy, connection, kindness and peace in all the days ahead.
Welcome to Blowing Bubbles, positive conversations with people in their bubbles, their safe spaces around the world. I am Samuel Mann. Over the last few months, we have been interviewing and playing the contributions from Mawira's sustainable management class, part of their master's degrees from the University of Otago. We've got a few more. Today, we have two. We have Dean Smith and Hector Mejia.
The road at Ash Valley was 7 metres underwater.
Wow. That is so much.
Oh, it's horrendous. I mean, it was devastating. There's no question about that.
Our guest today is John Painter. John is a fourth generation grower and the founder of the Yummy Fruit Co. He's widely regarded as an industry pioneer and he's made significant contribution to the New Zealand pit fruit, kiwi fruit and stone fruit industries. He was founding chairman of Zespri and also spent a lengthy period as a director of the New Zealand Apple and Pear Marketing Board. So, John, thank you very much for joining us.
My pleasure.
Excellent. I think the appropriate way to kick off, if you don't mind,
was to have a chat about where it all began for you. I believe the Painter family first started growing apples and stone fruit back in Nelson, is that correct?
We did in 1862. My great-grandfather was born in New Plymouth in 1844. And moved to Nelson in 1862 and bought a lifestyle property that already has apple trees on it. We have shipping records of him shipping 6 barrels of apples and a box of butter from the Port of Nelson to the Manukau Harbour in 1863.
Wow, that's fantastic. And then I guess there must have been a move north at some stage.
There was. I had two great-uncles. And the reason why they came here, they could see the population growth was going to be in the North Island.
So there's a story of innovation coming well back then. Yummy has had a clear ethos historically around innovation, sustainability, been involved in introducing natural predators into orchards, regenerative planting between crops, and water conservation as well. So can you talk about why these practices have been integrated into the Yummy business over time?
Well, these are biological industries with lots of factors influencing the outcome. Mm. It's important to get nature and the resources nature provides working for you. My dad had a great saying. He used to say to me, John, it's not starting the count, it's finishing that's important. And so many people in our industry come in with full of enthusiasm and they end up burning out.
Yeah.
They really don't have the ability to sustain the years. I mean, I've done 75 stone fruit seasons. Now next year we'll be on 76th, so full-time stone fruit season. And you've got to want to do it to stay that long.
It is a real sense of stewardship in terms of your connection to the land. How do you consider that as part of your organisation?
Well, in terms of the land, we're all temporary custodians for future generations, and that's certainly how we view it. I look back at my forebears and see what they did. And the knowledge they built up and the use of the land really was for future generations. So that's why they came to New Zealand. You know, our family arrived here on the beach in New Plymouth in 1841. And they really didn't come there for their generation. They came there for future generations. That's something that I've often thought about and thought, I better make a good job of my life to deliver from those guys. I'm at the end of my working career. And really, all I've done is provide the building blocks for future generations, either of our family or other people too.
I think that's very eloquently put. We touched a wee bit on nature and having to ride the highs and the lows. So
you've got the roof off the factory and you're exposed to the elements. That's one of the issues. You have to prepare for all eventualities. You have to have your land drained in case it floods, and you need irrigation in case it's dry, and you need frost protection and protection from wind and
all sorts. I am aware that you've experienced some significant challenges before. I believe, was it 1994, there was a catastrophic hailstorm which destroyed around 80% of your fruit.
That's right. It was a late season, and the 2nd of March, we got this horrendous hailstorm like we've never seen before since on the Herodon Plains. I mean, our packing shed's not small. We had hail bouncing through the doors into the middle of the pack house.
Wow.
It was absolutely horrendous. So we lost 80% of our revenue line in 10 minutes.
Devastating. So, absolutely brutal.
In those days, I only had 16 permanent staff. I got them all together at the end of the day and said, I can't promise you that you've all got a job at the end of the season. In fact, I don't know that I've got one. But if you stay with me 2 years, I'll pay you a significant bonus. I'm not telling you what it'll be because I don't know. But if you get out of this, I will pay you all a bonus. So by the end of the calendar year, we'd changed our strategy totally, and we'd captured 100% of our revenue line back by December.
What were those strategic changes, John?
That was the first year the apple market was deregulated in New Zealand,
of course.
And so I had almost a brand new Lexus car, about 8 months old. Rang up Lexus and said, I can't afford to keep this. I need the money to buy fruit. So I bought fruit off lots of people, probably 20 or 30 growers, and we used the Yummy brand on the local market.
Wow, that's an awesome story.
That was sustainability, that was survival.
No, but I guess that's financial sustainability as well.
Oh, very much.
Yes. We talk about the financial aspect of it, but you also mentioned your staff there and about people. And I know that there's a lot of people that rely on the success and the enduring success of Yummy for their well-being. You employ a lot of people.
Absolutely. Even now, this is the winter time, we've got well over 200 people on our staff at the moment. People say to me, I'd hate to have your wage bill in the season with 600 people and stuff. But it's a privilege to be able to pay these people. These are not just people, these are families, local families. This industry, more than any other land-based industry in the country, is a money go-around. The money earned from selling our fruit is multiplied many times out there in the community. If Hastings never really appreciated the horticultural industry in Hawke's Bay, they had a chance to appreciate it with the knock it caused from Cyclone Gabrielle.
You mentioned Cyclone Gabrielle. In terms of historic events, and we touched on some pretty tragic ones in relation to hail and other things, how do those historic events compare to the scale of what you observed with Cyclone Gabrielle?
So we lost 120,000 trees in East Valley, probably 40,000 apple trees and 80,000 stone fruit trees. We had 30% of our Bayview orchards lost, significant stone fruit, and quite a lot of apples at Miani. All the stone fruit at Parkaway, and we lost some apples there as well.
Wow. And just to provide some context to the magnitude of this flooding event, I've seen a report where I believe it was either you or Paul, your son, that referenced the depth of the floodwaters going through the East Valley at 7 metres.
7 metres, absolutely. Yeah. The road at East Valley was 7 metres underwater.
Wow. That is so much water.
Oh, it's horrendous. I mean, it was devastating. There's no question about that. In terms of world disasters, the fruit industries, that has to be one of the worst.
Yeah.
I mean, I didn't shed a tear or lose a night's sleep over any of it because the problem was too big to worry about.
So in terms of some of those immediate challenges, maybe if we could just sort of unpack slightly, I suppose, the different modes of recovery that you've had to go through. So initially, those first few days and weeks following the cyclone, what did that involve? Can you take me back there?
Well, the stone fruit harvest had been completed, so while we lost huge areas of stone fruit blocks, we hadn't lost the income from the stone fruit.
Right.
We had that in the bank. But the most devastating thing was that the bank took 30% of our working capital away from us. We had over 500 people on the staff, and for the first time in my life, I couldn't pay my bills on the 20th of the month. There's never been a generation of our family that couldn't pay their bills on time, but it happened to us because we had 30% of our working capital taken away from us. So it was a time of immense stress.
Yeah.
Keeping it all in perspective was pretty important.
Yeah.
So I spent hours on the phone talking to creditors that I couldn't pay them. So that went on for a good part of that financial year. It was about surviving in the short term, forget about the long term. Since then, we've had the Kanoa money for rebuilding the orchards, the Kanoa loan. But at that particular point, there was no help at all other than a bit of money from sort of silk feed and what have you.
And not at the scale that you need to run a business of this size.
It was horrendous, really. We somehow survived through that, but we shouldn't have. We were very close to being tipped over by the bank.
We're now moving into a slightly different phase of the recovery at this point, once that funding is secured. What are some of the longer-term challenges ahead in terms of the recovery?
Well, the passage of time is a very expensive cost. And so it's all very well to replant trees, but, you know, the time between replanting them and caring for them and getting production back is significant. You go through the recovery phase and then it's about holding on for another day. So that's the challenge at the moment. At the time of the cyclone, there were many factors running around my head about survival. How do we actually get out of this? And so the initial thrust was with short-term things, watching that daily cash flow. And what do we have to do to make sure we're still in business next week? But as we got through it, started to think about the longer term as well. And you know, we're very lucky to have picked up a significant Kanoa loan to help us with the rebuild of the productive. I mean, rebuilding the productive heart of the orchards is absolute number one. We've got lots of equipment we need to replace and cool cells we need to build and packing lines we need to change. But all that's off the agenda at the moment. None of that is a priority. You've got to get the productive heart back up again. Building the productive heart is the basis of our future.
And rebuilding it with those innovative new varieties and other things that are going to set you up to not put back what you had, but put back something a wee bit better, perhaps.
Better, absolutely. If we could come out the other side of this journey, this company will be bigger and stronger and better than it was. But we'll have left some blood on the floor on the way through.
That is resilience after all, isn't it? That is what it's about. I think that's a really great way of putting it. One of the hallmarks of Yummy is vertical integration. It's controlling the supply chain. And that actually starts before propagation even, doesn't it? Oh, when we talk about intellectual property, we talk about the importation.
Having the varieties and being in the pipeline at a controlling point where you're allowed to grow your own trees, that's quite unique.
Well, that's it. You don't need to go cap in hand to a third party to secure a license. You can actually control that. So on reflection, has that vertically integrated structure provided some advantages in your ability to respond from the
Absolutely. It's allowed us to propagate trees prolifically and much more cheaply than we could buy them at.
With that context in mind, how will Yari's recovery from the cyclone be different to simply rebuilding what was lost? How will it look different?
Well, it'll be very different. We haven't rebuilt like for like. For example, to borrow money and go into the Esk Valley again, where they can never solve the flood problem, would be foolish.
Yeah.
So under the Kanoa loan, we're allowed to plant other areas that we had earmarked for development in lieu of Esk Valley.
So have your views on sustainability changed at all through the Gabbro process?
There's no question about the climate. Whether you believe in classical climate change or not, the climate is changing. And we're getting a lot more remnants of tropical cyclones. If you look at the weather patterns over the last 12 months, there's been a huge number of ex-tropical weather events that have come down. So there's no question about the climate is drifting for whatever reason. It is changing. And I think the risk profile of this business has increased as a result of that.
Yeah. So you mentioned that the rebuild will be different, and you mentioned as well that there are some new varieties coming. Is there anything exciting in the pipeline that consumers might see out there?
Yes, there is. We've been fortunate. We have some very good contacts from overseas with our shareholding, the New Zealand Fruit Tree Company and C-Suite Limited. And also with the contacts that I've had for a lifetime with new varieties around the world. So it's an ongoing investment for us.
Rootstocks are part of that conversation. If we look at the rootstocks we're growing our trees on, you talk about the issues that were confronted post-cyclone in relation to wet feet within some of the stone fruit. Do you see rootstocks as being a potential solution for that?
There's a lot of improvement that can be made in that area. The year after we had our cyclone, Gabriel, the big stone fed areas of northern Italy had two big floods, very big floods. And I asked one of their growers, what sort of tree losses did you have? And he said, almost none, because ours are grown on pitch almond crosses, which are pretty good for wet feet.
I think that's something that we as an industry need to look into more deeply.
Oh, absolutely.
So, John, you've framed up a bit about your story in terms of your connection to the land and other things. If I was to ask you, where does John Painter feel most at home, what would the answer be?
I'm lucky that I've been doing everything from combing the world, looking for new varieties, to growing my own trees, planting new orchards, involved in the harvest and the marketing. So I've been lucky to be involved with production and right through to retail. I suppose I'm most happy in the field.
Yeah.
If you haven't got good production, you haven't got anything. If all you've got is the marketplace, then you're going to struggle a little bit. But on the other hand, I learned at a young age, so it's those producing the stuff either and not having a two-market strategy. And so I've loved both ends of this business, producing the fruit and selling. The most enjoyable thing I can do is to plant a new block of trees.
Yeah.
I love that. That's awesome. Really fantastic.
Brilliant. So, John, you've held a number of different roles. You've worn so many different hats in this industry. You've viewed it through different lenses. If we think about the world, where it's at now, and if you could be the supreme commander of the world for a day, what would you change? Is there anything that you would change?
That's a typical question for this interview. To be political leaders in this world today is not easy. Public expectations of leaders is high, and you need to be able to deliver in a short space of time because you don't have the luxury of long lead times. I suppose people are more critical than they used to be. You need to be proactive and innovative, and whatever you do, you need to be a bit pragmatic as well.
It's been lovely to sit down with you and chat about so many things. I personally have just really enjoyed it. So thanks, John. Thank you so much.
Thank you for coming.
Thank you.
I used to walk down the streets on my way to school, grinding my teeth to a rhythm invisible. I used my feet to crush dead leaves like they had fallen from trees, just for me, just to be. Crash cymbals. In class I passed the time, drawing a slash for every time. Secondhand went by a group of five, done 12 times just a minute. But Shamika said I had potential. 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 I used to march down the windy, windy sidewalk, slapping my leg with the riding crop, thinking it made me come off so tough. I didn't smile because a smile always seemed rehearsed. I wasn't afraid of the bullies, and that just made the bullies worse. In class I'd pass the time, drawing a slash for every time the second hand went by. A group of five done 12 times was a minute, but Shamika said I had potential. 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 Hurricane Gloria in Excelsis Deo. That's my bird and my tree. My dog and my man and my music is my holy trinity. Hurricane Gloria in Excelsis Deo. That's my bird and my tree. My dog and my man and my music is my holy trinity. Tony told me he described me as pissed off, funny and warm. Sebastian said I'm a good man and a stone. Back then I didn't know what potential meant. And Shamika wasn't gentle and she wasn't my friend. But she got through to me and I'll never see her again. She got through to me and I'll never see her again. I'm pissed off, funny and warm. I'm a good man in the storm. And when the fall is torrential, I'll recall. Shamika said I had potential. 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 Tony told me he described me as pissed off.
Shamika said I had potential. 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 Shamika said I had potential.
Was Fiona Apple with Shakima. See what I did there? Next up, for coming up for air, we have Hector Mejia talking about the political landscape around net zero.
I am Hector Mejia. I'm a student of the University of Otago in the program of Master in Sustainable Business. I have a bachelor's degree in environmental engineering and a post-study degree in environmental management. Climate change is no longer a distant threat. It is here, with heatwaves, floods, and rising global concern. New Zealand has committed to cutting greenhouse gas emissions, but the progress remains uncertain. Businesses now play a decisive role, whether by investing in green technologies, adopting renewable energies, or offsetting their emissions. In this podcast, we will explore a political landscape around zero emissions target and hear from a sustainability manager about her experience tackling this challenge. The Paris Agreement signed in 2016 committed New Zealand to reduce net emissions 50% below 2005 levels by 2030 and achieving net zero by 2050, with aim to keep global warming about 1.5 degrees. To support this, the Net Zero Carbon Act 2019 amended the Climate Change Response Act, setting the legally binding long-term targets, 5-yearly emission budget and reduction plans across key sectors such as energy, transport and agriculture. Research illustrates both challenge and possible solution. Raihan Atus-Peskova, in their study Towards Net Zero Emissions by 2050, The Road of Renewable Energy Technological Innovation and Forest in New Zealand, in 2023, found that 1% increase in economic growth raises emissions by 0.24%, however, expanding renewable energy can reduce emissions by 0.81%, forex expansion by 4.78%, and technological innovation by 0.02%. Similarly, Harshim in the publication, Decarbonization of the Industrial Sector through Greenhouse Gas Mitigation, Offset and Emission Trading Scheme in 2022, argues that each firm must reach its own net zero target, with the emissions trading scheme providing incentives through capped emissions and tradable allowances. Despite of the legislation, projections are worrying. The articles from RNZ in 2025 and The Guardian in 2024, how has Jacinda Ardern's groundbreaking climate law has become a shell, and New Zealand will fail to meet 2050 net zero targets, data shows after climate policy scrap, suggests that New Zealand may meet its two first budgets but overshoot the third in failing the 2050 target, relying too heavily on forestry to offset emissions. 46% of the planned reductions in the third budget come from tree planting alone. Critics, including Labour's Deborah Russell, argue that government is over-relying on emission trading scheme while cutting broader climate initiatives. The Climate Commission has warned that forestry offsets are unsustainable on the long term. The Climate Change Minister, Simon Watts, has defended a technology-led strategy, stressing that the government won't shut down productive sectors but will invest in research, development and planting more trees. Experts like Massey University professor Rod Sims warned that the current policies could increase annual emissions, especially in agriculture, transport and energy, where clear reduction strategies are lacking. For businesses, this creates a significant pressure. Regulation demands lower emissions, but many companies lack the resources to invest in low-carbon infrastructure. Brown often leads to higher emissions, making firms heavily dependent on offsetting. To see how this plays out in the practice, the guest invited will tell us about how they are addressing these challenges while working towards net zero. Hello and welcome to the podcast. Thank you for coming. To start with, tell me about yourself. What do you do?
Thank you. And I have over 10 years experience in sustainability and environmental management and certifications as well. And currently I'm working as a quality and sustainability manager at a company that does energy distribution for households and commercial customers.
Is there a moment that sparked your passion for sustainability?
Yes, I think I was lucky to discover my passion since early childhood. I used to love spending time at the garden and my grandfather's farm. Being with the animals and the plants really brought me joy. And as I grew up, I understood that I wanted to pursue a career on related to the environment, on biology or something similar. Of course, when you're studying in school, you don't know like the whole opportunities that universities can bring for studying different careers. And during one of the visits to one of those universities, I learned about forestry. And I realized that's what I wanted to do because I like studying full ecosystems and the impacts of the whole at the global scale or at a regional scale. And since then, I think I've been very lucky to be doing what I love.
How have your views on sustainability changed over time?
They have changed a lot because I began with a very strong passion for animal conservation and ecosystems conservation. And I was living on my early years of studies, I was living outside of the scope of my interest, the social aspect. And then as I continued studying, working, I learned that we cannot save the planet or save ecosystems without engaging the society and understanding the local needs of the communities that are reliant on these ecosystems and the environmental services that they provide to them. So now my main interest is understanding what are the needs of the communities or the customers or what is the economical structure that we have to find solutions that can help both the environment thrive and also the societies, because we need to make sure that everybody can have access to satisfy their needs.
From your sustainability report, the past year in the company had more emissions. Could you tell me what actions do you have in mind to reverse those figures?
Yeah, it's a journey that we are starting. This is the second sustainability report. Hence is the second carbon inventory that we have. And the first carbon inventory was the first exercise that we had. And it was a bit different from the current situation. So we have grown. The company diversified to not only providing service to our network, but also collaborating with our industries, so other companies in the same energy sector, and providing service to their network as well. So that means we expanded our geographic scope and diversified our services to also provide street lighting maintenance, which is a bit different from only providing services to the assets and ensuring that the assets provide the energy to the customers. So growth is a big factor that drove our increase in our emissions. as a gross, like overall, but also when considering by the revenue and by the total workers, that is also higher, but it's an indicator that helps us understand better, not only from the net gross emissions, but everything that has an impact, like our increase in staff and our increase in fleet and more offices or more areas that we are covering. Our priorities now are to continue understanding our emissions, identify where are the biggest opportunities to have what we call quick wins, where we can have the biggest impact in the shortest term, because we have the goal of reducing our emissions by 10% by 2030. So that's in about 4 years. So we have that big challenge, and then we aim to be carbon neutral by 2050, aligned to New Zealand's goals of also being carbon neutral by 2050. Priorities are exploring the electrical vehicles and hybrid vehicles. In our own conditions, hybrid seem to have more opportunities because we have over half of the staff spend more time on the field, providing services to a network or monitoring how it works, on doing the switch on work of the different transformers. So that requires them to be on site, and sometimes electric vehicles can have the limitation of the total kilometers that they can run with a full charge battery. Our staff tends to travel from one place to another, coming to the office maybe once a week. So we need to provide them also the tools that they need for their work, where hybrid can have more opportunity than EVs. But EVs can also be very helpful for our office staff and admin staff who don't travel that often to sites, or they can come and come back to the office for charging. So those are the opportunities we're exploring. We're also exploring the need for having EV chargers at our premises. Since we rent premises, it's also a challenge. We need to negotiate that with the landlords to collaborate with us in the energy efficiency that we are needing and aiming, and also for allowing us to do a few changes in the infrastructure so we can have everything that we need on site. Another big part of our emissions, besides fleet, is energy transmission losses. That's not very significant in terms of what New Zealand measures. I think by regulation it should be not over 5%, and nationally the transmission and distribution losses are just below 5. All the companies that does this type of work that are part of the same sector in average achieve that. When in our case, we are very efficient, we are just below 1%. So we don't have a lot of energy losses, which speaks about the good management of the assets and the service provided. However, they still account for our second highest emissions, but fleet is over 86%, and then the other 4% is our transmission and distribution losses. So we see that the 80% of emissions is mainly from our fleet. And the third significant part is the SF6, that we don't use it in all the assets, a very specific equipment that we have, which have been for a few years with us. They need from time to time to have a top up of SF6. In the last 3 years we haven't had it, so that wasn't accounted in this inventory, but it will be considered in future inventories because we had recent maintenance that required that. A big opportunity is to progressively degas those equipments, use the new technologies that are available, which also use greenhouse gas emissions, like fluorides gases, but they have less global warming potential than SF6. So instead of having plus 25,000 times, they will have plus 200 times. But that's something that our technical team is exploring. The engineers that are in charge of managing the network, they are assessing what can be compatible with the type of technology that we have, and also prioritizing with also modernizing our network. Many of the assets need to progressively be upgraded, and we need to make a plan that considers everything, the technical perspective and also the environmental perspective.
Thank you. Is the company considering joining any emission trade scheme or compensatory measure such as reforesting?
Yeah, that will be needed for us for achieving our carbon zero target by 2050. Being in the energy sector, it's very limited what we can do to actually avoid emitting our emissions. Even if we do our best for greening our fleet and replacing SF6, there will still be gases that have warming potential. So we have to explore those options. At the moment, we haven't prioritized or identified options, but we have to start that plan soon because we understand that in New Zealand, this scheme is very competitive, and yeah, many sectors might be aiming for the same carbon credits or certificates. Since we're in the energy sector, supporting renewable energy is very important. So aiming for those type of certificates will be also a priority in addition to any projects that are aiming at ecosystem restoration, not only forest, but also wetlands are very important here in New Zealand. Being a coastal country, any project that aims for conservation or restoration of wetlands and coastal areas, mangrove forest, are very important, so I think we will explore that. But first we need to make sure that we can mitigate as much as possible and to understand what is that gap that we need to compensate by offsetting the emissions through a certificate.
Please tell me, where do you feel most at home?
Speaking of sectors, I will say I will feel more at home in the agriculture sector because a great part of my 10 years experience was with the agriculture and food and beverage sectors. And the supply chain that relies on agriculture is globally very, very important. Food safety and efficient production of food and reducing food waste has been a great part of my life. Now I'm in a new industry outside of my comfort zone, if we can say so. However, it's also very interesting to learn because the energy sector is only growing and will not reduce as we continue to develop this reliance on technology, having more economical growth and activities and expanding our urban areas. That means more energy is needed. So the energy sector has a lot of potential also for growing, as well as agriculture. Both sectors are very vulnerable as well to climate change, agriculture more for sure, but the energy sector as well, because many of the assets are located in areas that can be affected easily by flooding, or by if there is an extreme climate event and the trees are lost or there's a landslide, our assets can be affected as well. So we need to make sure that we can provide energy because energy is part of the human recovery. So both sectors, I will say, are very important from my own experience in my own professional development. And once we start analyzing, all sectors are important. That's why we have such a diverse economy. But I will feel more at home where I can be more closer to nature and be in areas that have lots of urban landscapes.
If you could be the supreme commander of the world for a day, what would you change?
That's a very interesting question. I would love to be able to remove all the plastics that have been sent to the environment and remove all the 3 islands of floating plastic that we have in the Pacific and put a ban for that really works for plastics overall in single-use plastics especially. Because even if there have been some bannings of bags, that doesn't change the actual impact that it has, and there is a big issue with pollution and as being part of the fossil fuels industry as well, because plastic comes from petrol products. It can have a big impact if we start switching off not only from our energy sources, but also how our packages and almost anything we do that has plastic, our clothing, anything that we use, shoes, anything is part of it. So just making everybody more mindful and reducing to the most as possible. And that will have a very, not only visual impact, but also an impact for biodiversity. Because as we know, many of the animals are feeding on this plastic, sadly, affecting their health, affecting the human health as well. Plastic, even if not quite related to climate change, is a very important environmental issue because it only breaks down. It cannot be recycled fully. It only breaks into microplastics, and microplastics are also already in human blood, in the placenta of babies. So it's getting everywhere. So I think I would love to make a significant impact on that, but that needs to be systemic again as the solutions for climate change. That needs to be global, systemic, and make it available for everybody to be part of the solution.
Thank you very much for your answers.
Thank you very much. I enjoyed the conversation.
Just a small town girl living in a lonely world. She took the midnight train going anywhere. Just a city boy born and raised in South Detroit. He took the midnight train going. A singer in a smoky room, a smell of wine and cheap perfume. For a smile they can share the night. It goes on and on. We'll be right back.
I'm often critical of business in relation to sustainability. If business got us into this mess, how's it going to get us out of it? But I'm inspired by the journey that these learners are on, and their passion and their interest, and their not just taking things as a business as usual. You've been listening to Blowing Bubbles, positive conversations with people in their bubbles, their safe spaces around the world. We broadcast on Otago Access Radio every Wednesday afternoon at 3 and streamed and podcast on oar.org.nz. We are brought to you by the Sustainable Lens team, who are brought to you by Otago Polytechnic and the University of Otago. I'm Samuel Mann. That was Blowing Bubbles. We hope you enjoyed the show. This is Green Bay.
really have to wear a character. It's not happening today. It's just me. And I will do it.
This podcast was produced by ORFM Dunedin with support from New Zealand On Air.